April 16, 1945, Harry S. Truman, the 32nd President of the United States, speaks for the first time to a joint session of the Senate and House in the Capitol Building in Washington, D.C. The microphones of the Blue Network of the American Broadcasting Company are in place here in the chamber of the House of Representatives to bring you this important and historic event. The doorkeeper of the House, Ralph Roberts, will announce the arrival of the President in just a very few moments. Harry S. Truman, the first Missourian to hold the office of President of the United States, has arrived in the Capitol Building and will soon come into the House chamber to take his place at the clerk's desk on the Speaker's rostrum and deliver his first address since he assumed the presidency less than 100 hours ago. At the moment, we are speaking to you from the cloakroom directly across the House chamber from the Speaker's rostrum. Seated in the two chairs at the Speaker's desk are the Honorable Sam Rayburn, the Speaker of the House and the President pro tempore of the Senate, the Honorable Kenneth McKellar, Senator from Tennessee. On this historic occasion of President Truman's first address to a joint session of the House and Senate, the galleries are filled to overflowing. People are standing and are seated in the aisles of the galleries. The floor of the House is crowded. Every seat is taken and others are standing at the railing around the seat area. At the front of the House chamber, the Senate of the United States is in place in a wide band of reserved seats. In the well of the House, at the foot of the Speaker's rostrum, the President's cabinet, members of the Supreme Court, the military high command are in their seats awaiting the arrival of President Truman. He will be here in just a moment, and you will hear Ralph Roberts introduce him from the center door of the House chamber in the Capitol Building in Washington. To escort the President to his place, a committee on behalf of the House and of the Senate has been appointed. The members are, for the Senate, Albert Barkley of Kentucky, Wallace White of Maine, and Senator George of Georgia. For the House, the committee is composed of John McCormick and Joe Martin of Massachusetts, and Mr. Doughton of North Carolina. We understand that Senator Truman is just outside the center door. Here is Ralph Roberts.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
You have heard the doorkeeper of the House announce the entrance of the President. And there's the applause greeting Mr. Truman as he comes down the center aisle of the House of Representatives to take his place on the Speaker's rostrum at the clerk's desk, there to deliver this first address since he assumed the presidency. He's walking down the central aisle now in just a moment. Now on the Speaker's rostrum, he steps over. And the package, Mr. Rayburn, one to Mr. McKellar, and the committee that escorted the President here to the House chamber now filing by. President Truman is at his place at the clerk's desk, smiling at the members of the House and Representatives, and acknowledging this ovation that he is receiving as he comes here to make his first address and his assumption of the President. The President will be introduced by Mr. Rayburn, there at the gavel, and Mr. Rayburn will introduce the President of the United States.
Just a moment, let me present you, will you? Members of the Congress, I have the great pleasure and the high privilege of presenting to you the President of the United States.
The President has been introduced by the Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn. The members of the House and of the Senate, the President's Cabinet, the Supreme Court, and the galleries are on their feet now, applauding President Truman as he stands there at the clerk's desk on the Speaker's rostrum. He bows, nods his head around the room to acknowledge the applause.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of the Congress, it is with a heavy heart that I stand before you, my friends and colleagues, in the Congress of the United States. Only yesterday, we laid to rest the mortal remains of our beloved President, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. At a time like this, words are inadequate. The most eloquent tribute would be a reverent silence. Yet in this decisive hour, when world events are moving so rapidly, our silence might be misunderstood and might give comfort to our enemies. In his infinite wisdom, Almighty God has seen fit to take from us a great man who loved and was beloved by all humanity. No man could possibly fill the tremendous void left by the passing of that noble soul. No words can ease the aching hearts of untold millions of every race, creed, and color. The world knows it has lost the heroic champion of justice and freedom. Tragic fate has thrust upon us grave responsibilities. We must carry on. Our departed leader never looked backward. He looked forward and moved forward. That is what he would want us to do. That is what America will do. So much blood has already been shed for the ideals which we cherish and for which Franklin Delano Roosevelt lived and died, that we dare not permit even a momentary pause in the hard fight for victory. Today, the entire world is looking to America for enlightened leadership to peace and progress. Such a leadership requires vision, courage, and tolerance. It can be provided only by a united nation deeply devoted to the highest ideal. With great humility, I call upon all Americans to help me keep our nation united in defense of those ideals which have been so eloquently proclaimed by Franklin Roosevelt. I want, in turn, to assure my fellow Americans and all of those who love peace and liberty throughout the world that I will support and defend those ideals with all my strength and all my heart. That is my duty, and I shall not shirk it. So that there can be no possible misunderstanding, both Germany and Japan can be certain, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that America will continue to fight for freedom until no vestige of resistance remains. We are deeply conscious of the fact that much hard fighting is still ahead of us. Having to pay such a heavy price to make complete victory certain, America will never become a party to any plan for partial victory. To settle for merely another temporary respite would surely jeopardize the future security of all the world. Our demand has been, and it remains, unconditional surrender. We will not traffic with the breakers of the peace on the terms of the peace. The responsibility for making of the peace, and it is a very grave responsibility, must rest with the defenders of the peace. We are not unconscious of the dictates of humanity. We do not wish to see unnecessary or unjustified suffering. But the laws of God and of man have been violated, and the guilty must not go unpunished. Nothing shall shake our determination to punish the war criminals, even though we must pursue them to the ends of the earth. Lasting peace can never be secured if we permit our dangerous opponents to plot future wars with impunity at any mountain retreat, however distant. In this shrinking world, it is futile to think safety behind geographical barriers. Real security will be found only in law and in justice. Here in America, we have labored long and hard to achieve a social order worthy of our great heritage. In our time, tremendous progress has been made toward a really democratic way of life. Let me assure the forward-looking people of America that there will be no relaxation in our efforts to improve the lot of the common people. In the difficult days ahead, unquestionably, we shall face problems of staggering proportions. However, with the faith of our fathers in our hearts, we do not fear the future. On the battlefield, we have frequently faced overwhelming odds and won. At home, Americans will not be less resolute. We shall never cease our struggle to preserve and maintain our American way of life. At this moment, America, along with her brave allies, is paying again a heavy price for the defense of our freedom. With characteristic energy, we are assisting in the liberation of entire nations. Gradually, the shackles of slavery are being broken by the forces of freedom. All of us are praying for a speedy victory. Every day peace is delayed costs a terrible toll. The armies of liberation today are bringing to an end Hitler's ghastly threat to dominate the world. Tokyo rocks under the weight of our bombs. The grand strategy of the United Nations war has been determined, due in no small measure to the vision of our departed Commander-in-Chief. We are now carrying out our part of that strategy under the able direction of Admiral Leahy, General Marshall, Admiral King, General Arnold, General Eisenhower, Admiral Nimitz, and General MacArthur. I want the entire world to know that this direction must and will remain unchanged and unhampered. Our debt to the heroic men and valiant women in the service of our country can never be repaid. They have earned our undying gratitude. America will never forget their sacrifices. Because of these sacrifices, the dawn of justice and freedom throughout the world slowly casts its gleam across the horizon. Our forefathers came to our rugged shores in search of religious tolerance, political freedom, and economic opportunity. For those fundamental rights, they risked their lives. We well know today that such rights can be preserved only by constant vigilance, the eternal price of liberty. Within an hour after I took the oath of office, I announced that the San Francisco conference would proceed. We will face the problems of peace with the same courage that we have faced and mastered the problems of war. In the memory of those who have made the supreme sacrifice, in the memory of our fallen president, we shall not fail. It is not enough to yearn for peace. We must work and, if necessary, fight for it. The task of creating a sound international organization is complicated and difficult. Yet, without such organization, the rights of man on earth cannot be protected. Machinery for the just settlement of international differences must be found. Without such machinery, the entire world will have to remain an armed camp. The world will be doomed to deadly conflict, devoid of hope for real peace. Fortunately, people have retained hope for a durable peace. Thoughtful people have always had faith that ultimately justice must triumph.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to hear an address by Dr. Albert Einstein, world-famous scientist. Dr. Einstein was scheduled to address a federal world government rally being held this evening by former GI students of Northwestern University in the Chicago Stadium. However, Dr. Einstein was unable to travel to Chicago for this occasion and is instead addressing the students by radio from his home in Princeton, New Jersey. He will be introduced by Dr. Paul A. Schilt of the Department of Philosophy at Northwestern University. Dr. Schilt.
Mr. Chairman, fellow students, ladies and gentlemen, I have the distinguished honor and personal privilege to present to you on this auspicious occasion the world-renowned theoretical physicist whose original work, more than that of any other living scientist, led to the discovery and development of atomic energy. Fortunately, the world's greatest living scientist is also the kind of a person who has as much of his social conscience as he has scientific insight and vision. In presenting him to you this evening, therefore, from his simple American home here in Princeton, I give you not merely a great scientist, but the equally as great citizen of the world, Dr. Albert Einstein.
Ladies and gentlemen, the conversation I had with three students of your university has made a strong impression on me. It showed me that a sense of responsibility and initiative is at work in the young generation of this country. These students are aware of the fact that the destiny of the new generation will be decided in these few years. They are determined to influence the pace of events within the framework of their possibilities. What is the situation? The development of technology and of the implement of war is all about something akin to a shrinking of our planet. Economic interlinking has made the destiny of nations interdependent to a degree far greater than in previous years. The available weapons of destruction are of a kind such that no place on earth is safeguarded against certain total destruction. The only hope for protection lies in securing a seat in a supranational world. A world government must be created which is able to solve conflicts between nations by traditional decisions. This government must be based on a clear-cut constitution which is approved by the government and the nation, and which gives it the sole disposition of offensive weapons. A person or a nation can be considered peace-loving only if it is ready to cede its military force to the international authority and to renounce every attempt or even the means of achieving its interests abroad by the use of force. It is apparent that the development of the political revolution in the year which has elapsed since the conclusion of the Second World War has brought us in no way near to the achievement of this goal. The UN, as it stands today, has neither the military force nor the legal basis to bring about a state of international security. Nor does it take account of the actual distribution of power. Real power is at present in the hands of a few nations. It is no exaggeration to say that the solution of the real problem is linked solely to an agreement on a grand scale between this country and Russia. For if such an agreement would be achieved, then these two powers alone would be able to cause the other nations to give up their sovereignty to the degree of necessary for the establishment of military security for all. Now, many will say that fundamental agreement with Russia is impossible under the present circumstances. Such a statement would be justified if the United States had made a serious attempt in this direction during the past year. I find, however, that the opposite has happened. There was no need to accept fascist Argentine into the UN against Russia's opposition. There was no need to manufacture new atomic bombs without let up and to appropriate $12 billion of war defense in a year in which no military threat was to be expected for the near future. Nor was it necessary to delay the proposed measures against Franco's state. It is senseless to recount here the details which all show that nothing has been done in order to alleviate Russia's distress, a distress which can very well be understood in the light of the events of the last decade, and to whose origin we have contributed no little. A permanent peace cannot be prepared by threat, but only by the honest attempt to create mutual trust. One truth is that the wish to create a decent form of life on this planet and to avert the danger of unspeakable destruction would tame the passions of responsible man. You cannot rely on that, my young friend. May you succeed in activating the young generation in this sense, so that it will strive for a policy of peace on a grand scale. Thus you can not only defend yourself successfully, but you can serve your country and your descendants in a degree as was not given to any previous generation.
Professor Einstein, in the light of what you have just told us, I am sure your radio audience would like to know what precisely is the real difference between world government and the United Nations organization. Would you care to enlighten us on this point?
Under the world government, I understand an institute whose decisions and prescriptions are binding for the individual state. It is an institution, therefore, which among the present nations of the world is analogous to that relationship which exists between the government in Washington, D.C. and the 48 states of the Union. In its present form, the UN does not possess the powers of a world government because its decisions and determinations hold no binding power over the individual government.
Here is one of the students who has worked hard on the Chicago rally and on this broadcast, Mr. Foster Parmalee, who is Secretary Treasurer of the National Organization of Students Federally, who has a question for you, Professor Einstein.
I'm a university student and a veteran of World War II. My fellow students and I would like very much to know what you, Professor Einstein, think that we, the young people of the world, can do to achieve a federation of the world, just as the original 13 states achieved in this country 160 years ago.
Before anything else, the young generation must become clear in its own mind what minimum conditions must be met in order to stop reciprocal military threats of one nation by any other nation or combinations of nations in the future. The second task would be to spread this knowledge throughout the country. The third task would require the organization of activities in such a way as to influence the representatives in Congress and in the individual state assemblies in such a fashion as to lead to the realization of the will of the people.
Do you believe, Professor Einstein, that mutual envy and hatred among nations can be overcome by a world government?
No, of course not. But a world government would be able to prevent that such natural emotional reactions should lead to acts of violence between nations.
Professor Einstein, does any industrial country in the world possess the natural resources and scientific ability to produce atomic weapons?
At any rate, enough such resources and ability in order to constitute a continuous and unbearable threat to each other.
From this last answer, Professor Einstein, I take it that you, who knows as much as any living person about the threat of atomic bombs to the future of humanity on this planet, consider the establishment of real world government as an inescapable necessity at the earliest possible moment?
There can no longer be any doubt about this absolute necessity. For this reason, everything that is done in international affairs must be done from the following viewpoint. Will it help or hinder the establishment of world government?
You have just heard an address by Dr. Albert Einstein, world-famous scientist. Dr. Einstein, who spoke from his home in Princeton, New Jersey, was addressing a federal world government rally being held tonight in the Chicago Stadium under the auspices of the former GI students of Northwestern University.
Dr. Einstein was introduced by Dr. Paul A. Schilt of the Department of Philosophy of Northwestern University. Mr. Foster Parmalee, Secretary Treasurer of the National Organization of Student Federalists, also questioned Dr. Einstein. We return you now to our New York studios.
Thank you.